The rest of the IPA focuses upon the location and behavior of your tongue. In Appendix 4, I give you an IPA decoder chart. Anytime you come up across some weird sound you don't understand, you can load up the Wikipedia article for your language, e.g. IPA for Spanish or IPA for Swahili, and compare it to the chart. The chart will tell you what to do with your tongue, your lips, and your vocal cords. You can use this chart as a universal decoder device that translates a word like mjöðr into a series of tongue, lip, and vocal cord positions. Coupled with your newly trained ears, you'll have a much easier time mimicking each new sound in your language. Backchaining. How to get ridiculous words into your mouth. So, you've dutifully learned each of your sounds. You fling open your textbook and run face first into a German word like Höchstgeschwindigkeitsbegrenzung, speed limit. Now what? Each of the sounds isn't particularly hard, but how do you get your tongue to jump through so many hoops in a row? Go backward. Say the end of the word and then add one letter at a time until you can say the whole thing. Let's try the Russian word for flinch, as in, I flinch whenever I see this word, вздрогну. It manages to string together four consonants in a row before reaching its first vowel, ik. We'll go backward. While you might have trouble saying вздрогну, you can say ну. Now you can add a letter and practice saying гну. Once that's comfortable, keep building up one letter at a time. О, гну. Огну. Р, огну. Рогну. Д, рогну. Дрогну. З, дрогну. Здрогну. This one is tricky. You want to buzz like a bee, з, and then say дрогну. Здрогну. And then в, здрогну. Вздрогну. Same story with that one. Вздрогну. Now, say that 10 times fast. This is called backchaining, and it's an old singer trick that can work tongue-related miracles. You're using muscle memory to trick your tongue into doing things it wasn't able to do before. While your tongue can't handle 8 new movements at once, it can handle a single new combination of 2 familiar sounds. If you split long, difficult words into small, easy chunks, you'll find that your tongue is capable of remarkable acrobatic feats. You may wonder why we're going backward. After all, we could start with v and progress to vz, vzd, vzr, and so on. Indeed, you can, but in my experience, it doesn't work as well. By going backward, you practice the end of the word every time you add a letter. This makes it easier and easier to finish the word correctly and automatically. Because of this, you only need to focus your attention for a brief moment at the very beginning. And then you can let your tongue go on autopilot for the rest of the word. Höchstgeschwindigkeitsbegrenzung. By making the end of the word as easy and familiar as possible, you'll never get lost on the way there. Key points. 1. Impressions matter, and your accent makes your first impression in any language. A good accent can make the difference between a conversation that starts in French and ends in English, and a full conversation in French. 2. Improve your accent by learning the raw ingredients, the tongue, lip, and vocal cord positions of every new sound you need. You can find that information in the International Phonetic Alphabet, or IPA. 3. If you run into difficult combinations of sounds, backchain them together until your tongue performs automatically. Train your eyes. See the patterns. You know how to train your ears to hear new sounds, and you know how to train your mouth to produce them. But how do you know which sounds to produce? Somehow you have to connect the writing system of your language to your mouth and ears. Now, wait a second. What if you only want to speak? Kids learn languages without first learning to read. Why can't adults? Well, we can, but it's time-consuming and expensive. Kids learn languages by listening and watching adults for thousands upon thousands of hours. Adults will do this for free for their own kids, but those same adults will tend to charge you a lot of money. The written word, on the other hand, is plentiful and free. Even if you never intend to read a book in French, you can get 1,000 illustrated examples of every word in your language from Google Images. This is too good a resource to ignore. The problem with written resources is the danger of broken words, our Descartes and Descartes. And this is the problem we must overcome. This challenge is different in every language, because every language shows a different degree of correspondence between its spelling and pronunciation. English is one of the worst offenders when it comes to our spelling system. It is legendary for its wackiness. But even English operates under a large set of dependable rules, which is why you can predict the pronunciation of fake words like G-H-I-G-H-T, or gite. Even in Chinese, a language where single characters refer to whole words rather than sounds, you'll find that the characters often contain pronunciation hints, a feature that allows Chinese native speakers and advanced Chinese students to predict the pronunciation of new characters. Every language has its patterns, and we make our job much easier if we can get those patterns into our heads. This task can be a piece of cake if we know what we're doing. We're very good at internalizing patterns. Even a 5-year-old knows that dogs are dogs with a Z at the end and cats are cats with an S. There is only one prerequisite to learning a new pattern. We need to notice it when it passes by. We can do this in many ways. We could listen to recordings of every new word we read, for example. But perhaps the best way to do this involves a phonetic alphabet. This is not to say that recordings aren't helpful. I think they're great, necessary even. It's just that sometimes we need to be told what we're hearing before we can truly hear it. We've already encountered one good phonetic alphabet, the IPA. But the particular alphabet is less important than the information it conveys. We're looking for a way to see what we're hearing, and equally important, what we're not hearing. Our eyes are a powerful source of input. If we aren't careful, they can trick our ears into a state of inattention, and inattention can prevent us from learning the patterns we need. I once showed a friend one of my digital flashcards for French. It had a picture of a cat with the word chat underneath, spelled C-H-A-T, and it played a recording of the word. Chat, said the recording, since the T at the end of chat is silent. Shot, repeated my friend. No, it's chat, I corrected. Oh, okay, he replied. Shot. I run into this problem a lot with my English speakers. It is terribly difficult to get a student to say listen instead of listen when he sees a word like L-I-S-T-E-N. This problem vanishes as soon as I teach them a phonetic alphabet. No one pronounces the T in listen when they're reading it phonetically. When I learn a language, I tend to use a combination of recordings and a phonetic alphabet, at least until the little Frenchman in my head starts sounding very French. Then I stop with the recordings and rely on my phonetic alphabet. If my language is very friendly, phonetically speaking, I'll phase out my phonetic alphabet once I'm feeling overconfident about my pronunciation. Now, do you need to learn a new phonetic alphabet? Well, not really, especially if your language has relatively simple and strict spelling rules, like Spanish or Hungarian. You can rely upon recordings instead. But even for those languages, a phonetic alphabet can make your job easier in two ways. It helps you to see and hear whenever a sound rule shows up, when you're reading W-U-G-S but saying wugs with a Z at the end, and it gives you one more way to look at the same information. Because of the quirky nature of memory, this makes your task easier. By learning more, you'll work less. More is less. The learning paradox. On the surface, it seems like you have a lot to do. You're building connections between your ears, your mouth, spelling, and a phonetic alphabet. I promised you an easy, fast learning method, and I've given you a giant pile of new things to learn. Instead of R-U-E, pronounced rue, street, I'm giving you this. R. Spellings in French, just R. Symbol in IPA, an upside-down R. Tongue position, from Appendix 4. Back of your tongue should touch your uvula, a little bit behind K. Type of consonant, from Appendix 4. It's a trill. You let your uvula flap up and down rapidly against your tongue. Vocal cords, from Appendix 4. Buzzing. U-E, symbol in IPA. Lowercase y. Tongue position, from Appendix 4. Tongue up and forward, like E. Lips, from Appendix 4, in a circle, like oo. We haven't even gotten to the street part. What the hell? I'm doing this on purpose, and here's why. The more you can learn about something, the easier time you'll have mastering it, and the less time you'll need over the long term. If you're trying to make the foreign sounds of your new language familiar, then your easiest, shortest path is to learn as much as you possibly can about those sounds. This phenomenon shows up in every subject. As a kid, I loved math. It had this neat quality because everything was connected. You memorize that 3 times 4 is 12, and then you learn that 4 times 3 is also 12, and eventually you start realizing that you can switch the order of any two numbers you're multiplying. You see that 3 times 4 and 4 times 3 are examples of something much larger, some abstract floating pattern known as multiplication, and every new example helps you hold more of that giant floating pattern in your head. That pattern changes and becomes more subtle and nuanced with every little fact you learn. Soon you begin to see the connections between multiplication and division, multiplication and exponents, and multiplication and fractions. Eventually, your giant floating pattern of multiplication becomes part of a bigger floating pattern, a universe of math. As long as I could connect every new thing I learned to this universe, I had an easy time with math. And I noticed that classmates who had problems with math weren't struggling with math. They were struggling with connections. They were trying to memorize equations, but no one had successfully shown them how those equations connect with everything they had already learned. They were doomed. At some point along their path, their interconnected math universe had shattered into fragments, and they were trying to learn each piece in isolation, an extremely difficult proposition. Who could possibly remember the formula for the volume of a hexagonal prism? How could you make yourself care enough to actually remember? It was so much easier if you could just see how all the pieces interrelated, how multiplication connected with the area of rectangles, how the area of rectangles connected with triangles and trapezoids, and how the volume of prisms connected back with multiplication. I didn't have to memorize formulas. They were just examples of something much, much larger. Math can be hard for the same reason that languages can be hard. At some point, you miss a connection, and if no one goes back, takes you by the hand, and shows you that connection, and you're suddenly doomed to memorize crappy formulas. We know why this is so. We've already discussed the nature of memory. Every time we can connect two memories, we strengthen both of them. Neurons that fire together, wire together. If you learn that the accented E in the French word mère sounds like E, you've built one connection. If you then learn that the AI in lait or milk is also pronounced E, then you've built three connections. The sound E connects with le, E connects with mère, and le connects with mère. These three connections are much easier to remember than your original accented E is equal to E. By adding more pieces to learn, you're making your job much easier. You're learning faster, which means less work over time. Now, naturally, there are limits. There's an art to building memories. It takes balance. You could spend days learning trivia about E, and it won't necessarily help you learn French. On the other hand, if you skipped it and I simply told you to learn a bunch of French words, you'd be back in math class, memorizing formulas. How can you determine where more is less and where more is just more? The key is relevance. If you see something as useful, then it's worth learning. If not, then not. In Appendix 4, I give you a decoder for the entire IPA. But if your favorite textbook or dictionary doesn't use IPA symbols, then don't memorize IPA symbols. Just use them for a reference. If you know how to pronounce E already, and you do, then you don't need to worry about the location of your tongue. On the other hand, if a sound seems foreign and difficult, then go nuts. Learn everything. Learn its spellings, its behavior in your mouth, its relationship to the other sounds you already know. See how your textbook or dictionary notates it. Find some example words. Do whatever you can. The more you do, the less work it will be. It's magic. Key points. 1. Every language contains a pattern of connections between its spelling and its sounds. If you can internalize that pattern and make it automatic, you'll save yourself a great deal of work. 2. The easiest way to internalize those patterns is to use your SRS. Create flashcards to memorize every spelling pattern you need. 3. In the process, approach foreign words and complex patterns from as many angles as you can, from their spellings to their sounds, even down to the individual mouth positions used for each sound. You're taking advantage of one of the stranger quirks of learning. The more bits and pieces you learn, the less work it takes to learn them. Do this now. Learn your language's sound system. It doesn't necessarily take much time to learn a language's sound system. If you're learning a language like Spanish, you can listen to a few recordings, look at a few example words of each spelling in your language, and move on to vocabulary. If you're learning Arabic, you have a bit more work to do. But work is too strong a word. I find that working with sound is deeply satisfying and fun, and I don't believe that's just because I'm a singer. I think it's the other way around. Sound is the way we connect our thoughts to our bodies. We see an eagle in the sky, we turn to a companion, and our tongue flies up and forward, our lips fly open, and our vocal cords engage. Eagle. To paraphrase Rousseau, when we learn an accent, we are taking on the soul of that language. This isn't work, it's communion. So let's get communing. Towards the end of this book, you'll find the gallery. There you'll learn how to make pronunciation flashcards. But the extent to which you'll use them, or whether you'll use them at all, depends upon which path you choose. There are two basic paths through pronunciation: the standard route and the off-road route. The standard route uses published resources, either a grammar book with a CD or a special book CD combo, dedicated exclusively to pronunciation. If your grammar book comes with recordings, it likely contains a series of pronunciation lessons scattered throughout the book. Ignore all the vocabulary and grammar in your book and jump to each pronunciation section. There, listen to and mimic the recordings and then move on to the next pronunciation lesson until you're done. If your grammar book is text only, then consider buying a dedicated pronunciation book with a CD and working through it from cover to cover. If you need help remembering a given sound or spelling, then you can pick and choose whichever flashcards you need from the gallery. The off-road route takes the tools we've found: minimal pair tests for ear training, the IPA for mouth instructions, and our SRS for getting it all into our heads, and builds a pronunciation trainer out of them. These trainers test your ears until you can hear your new language's sounds, connect those sounds to the spelling patterns in your language, and dump that information into your head through your SRS. I've tried to make your job easier by doing as much of the grunt work as possible. I'm creating trainers as fast as I can in as many languages as I can. If I've done one for your language, then grab it. These trainers are cheaper than a pronunciation guidebook, and they should do a much better and faster job than the standard route. If you use these, you won't need to make any flashcards now. Just download them, install them, and within a few weeks you'll have pronunciation mastered. If I haven't done your language, or if you prefer to do things yourself, then jump to the first gallery. There, I'll show you how to make your own pronunciation trainer in a few hours. You'll use a combination of resources. Resources. A quick tour of the pronunciation toolshed. Pronunciation resources are a mixed bag. Some textbooks begin with a detailed chapter devoted to the alphabet, spelling, and sounds, with CDs brimming with individual phonemes, minimal pairs, example words, and example sentences. Other textbooks give you a passing overview. Some French vowels are nasal, and move on. Here's what's at your fingertips. Free resources. Forvo.com for free recordings of words. Essential tool. First things first, get acquainted with Forvo.com. That's Forvo.com. Free native speaker recordings of more than 2 million words in 300 languages. Once you start making flashcards, Forvo will become your best friend. If you're using Anki, put recordings from Forvo into your flashcards. If you're using a Leitner box, go through your vocabulary list at least once a week. Read your newest words aloud. Play their recordings on Forvo. And if you didn't sound the same, repeat until you do. Once you're consistently accurate with your pronunciation, you can stop double-checking. But until then, stick with it. There's no reason to become fluent in a badly pronounced language because no one will speak it with you. Resource 2, rhinospike.com. Rhinospike is a handy website for native speaker recordings. You submit a text and someone will record it for you, usually within 24 to 48 hours. If your textbook has a list of minimal pairs but doesn't come with a recording of those pairs, you can get someone on Rhinospike to record those words for you. It's also a lovely place to get recordings of full sentences with intonation. So if your textbook has some example sentences, put them up on Rhinospike as well. Number 3. My Pronunciation YouTube Series. fluent-forever.com/chapter-3. Essential tool. Go watch these videos. They take you on a tour of your mouth and the IPA. They make pronunciation understandable. And they give you access to one of the most powerful pronunciation tools available, the IPA. Number 4. Wikipedia's IPA for Spanish, IPA for French, and so on. Essential tool. This is a tool I mentioned earlier. You can copy all of Wikipedia's example words for each sound, and you can use it with Appendix 4 to get mouth instructions for any weird sound in your target language. 5. Online dictionaries. Wiktionary.org. Wiktionary is turning into a great resource for many languages, with pronunciation entries in IPA for many words. 6. Other online dictionaries. Each language has several online dictionaries, some of which are excellent. I have the best ones linked on my website. Digital dictionaries with pronunciation information are extremely handy if you're using Anki. You can put in your word, copy the pronunciation information, and paste it directly onto your flashcards in seconds. 7. YouTube. YouTube contains resources of mixed and undependable quality, but I found it particularly helpful when it comes to questions like, how do I roll my Spanish R? You're not necessarily listening to experts, but you are often listening to native speakers who have good tips. 8. The Foreign Service Institute, fsi-languages.wojik.eu. This has 41 languages worth of free public domain textbooks online, most of which come with MP3s and about half of which start with a detailed pronunciation section, complete with minimal pair tests, spelling rules, and the works. These courses are old and some of them are extraordinarily boring, but many contain excellent recordings. If you can stay awake through them, you'll get all the information you need. Paid resources. 1. My Pronunciation Trainers, fluent-forever.com/chapter-3. These trainers provide you with minimal pair tests, spelling rules, example words, and enough vocabulary to ingrain the sounds and spelling patterns of your new language in your head. They run on Anki, and over the course of using them, you'll get a sense for how Anki works, and you'll be ready to make your own flashcards. 2. italki.com, italki.com. Italki can get you in touch with native speakers, who will talk with you or train you for very small amounts of money or in exchange for an equal amount of time speaking in English. You can spend an hour going through words with them and asking them to correct your pronunciation, which can help immensely. 3. A Good Pronunciation Guidebook. A guidebook will come with a CD, provide diagrams of your mouth and tongue, and walk you through the entire pronunciation system of your language. The best of these will include minimal pair tests as well. These books don't exist in every language, but they're extraordinarily helpful when they do. 4. An exceptionally good textbook CD combo. This will start with a good pronunciation guidebook and provide you with everything you need. 5. A good dictionary. A good dictionary will give you a guide to its phonetic alphabet, which may range from a couple of occasional marks to full-blown IPA, or full-blown something random the publisher decided upon, and may even begin with a good discussion of the spelling rules. If you buy a physical dictionary with clear pronunciation information, then you can use it to easily browse for example words when you're making your first flashcards. For the intermediates. Some intermediate language learners get lucky. They studied with teachers who stressed excellent pronunciation habits and, as such, built a solid foundation. They have no trouble hearing the sounds of their target language, they have good pronunciation, and they've built an intuitive sense of the connections between sound and spelling. Others aren't so lucky. You'll need to do an honest assessment of your abilities. Then you can pick and choose the tools that you need. If you have trouble hearing the differences between similar sounds in your language, say the difference between roux and rue in French, then you should use minimal pair testing to help. Use one of my pronunciation trainers. It's what they're there for. If you can hear the sounds, but you have trouble producing them, then play around in Appendix 4, or get a tutor on italki.com to coach you on pronunciation until you get a feel for your target language's sounds in your mouth. If you can't quite remember which spellings make which sounds, then just use the flashcards in the first gallery of this book. Any effort you put in now will speed up your progress for the rest of your journey. It'll also ensure that native speakers actually speak to you instead of switching to English at the earliest opportunity. Chapter 4. Wordplay and the Symphony of a Word. Das Aussprechen eines Wortes ist gleichsam ein Anschlagen einer Taste auf dem Vorstellungsklavier. Uttering a word is like striking a note on the keyboard of the imagination. Ludwig Wittgenstein. Boy, those French. They have a different word for everything. Steve Martin. On the surface, words are simple. We point to a fuzzy animal and name it. Dog. And so a word begins. But this is just a fragment of the story. In the last chapter, we learned how to hear a language's sounds, but we haven't yet learned to hear its music. And we need to, because we're aiming for fluency. We want to speak our minds without thinking about grammar or translations, and the key to this ability lies beneath the surface of every word. There, if we learn how to listen, we will hear a quiet symphony. In this chapter, you'll find the tools you need to hear this symphony. These tools will teach you what the French think of when they picture déjeuner, lunch, and give you the bare grammatical necessities to talk about déjeuner when you're ready. We'll discuss which words to learn first and how to learn them easily. You'll learn how to skip translating and think in a new language from the very beginning. So, what's hiding beneath the surface of our words? A word in your brain contains within it every neural pattern it's ever connected. Your dog contains a fragment of every dog you've ever seen, heard, or read about. It's shaped by thousands of experiences that you and I have never shared. And yet, we can talk about dog, and our brains light up in mostly the same way. Words are, after all, our communal brain. As a group, we point at things and say corresponding words until our minds and brains tune to each other. An orchestra of minds so immense that the violist in Los Angeles can't possibly hear the violinist in Pennsylvania. And yet, here we are, playing in perfect harmony and perfect rhythm all the same. It is an impossible thing, a word. And it's not as if the chords we play are simple. They contain thousands of notes connecting sound and spelling to meaning and grammar. The grammar provides the lowest notes. You and I would never talk about an dog, or dog as we might talk about an elephant or beer. This is the grammar of a dog, and it vibrates in our skulls, a throbbing sustained note from the cello section. Sound and spelling are playing too, naturally. They're probably in the woodwinds, and they tell us to write D-O-G-S and say dogs without a second thought as to why. Meaning serves as the melody, and it's no simple ditty. It's a cacophony of images, stories, and associated words. I can point to a little yappy ball of fur and say dog, and you will agree. Yes, you will say, that is a dog. I can then point to a giant Great Dane and say dog, and you will still agree. I can even say things like, in a remarkable display of dogged determination, he won the race, and you will still understand even in the absence of actual dogs in our story. Beyond 20 or so dog definitions, there is a multitude of kindred words. When dog enters your brain, 1,000 of these words spring to the ready, and 10,000 unrelated words recoil and retreat. A dog barks, but it doesn't yell or shout. You can pursue someone doggedly, but you usually don't doggedly eat a sandwich, even if it's a very large sandwich. Words go together automatically, and you instinctively know which ones fit and which ones don't. All of these pieces, the bits of grammar, the sounds, the spellings, the meanings, and the connected words, are contained within the immense symphony known as dog. And the moment I tell you that sobaka is the Russian word for dog, that whole symphony collapses into a single out-of-tune horn solo. Bwah. Russian dogs are not your friends. You can speak fluently because your words fit together automatically. When you think dog, you instantly gain access to the 1,000 words that might come next in your story. Your dog might yip or bark or save Timmy from the well. You have multi-layered instincts built into your dog, and you lose those instincts the moment you translate that word into another language. Why? Because translations strip the music out of words. Our dog symphony only exists in English. No one else can hear it. When I was in Russian school, we watched a movie where the protagonist got drunk, forgot his shotgun, and got eaten by sobakas. Seriously. In English, dogs are man's best friend. In Russian, sobakas leave behind empty, tooth-marked boots. I've told you that sobaka is the Russian word for dog, but it's not quite true. Even if a Chihuahua and a Great Dane are types of sobaka, we're still missing the rest of the orchestra. Where's the grammar, the pronunciation, or the spelling? Where are the alternative meanings of the word? You'll never hear about displays of sobaka determination. Where are the kindred words that bring sobaka to life in your mind and mouth? Let's learn to hear the symphony in our new words. Because once you can hear it, you'll never want to hear translation, that out-of-tune horn player, again. Where to begin? We don't talk much about apricots. Some people have a way with words, and other people... not have way. Steve Martin. You can't learn the music in your words before you know which words to learn. How can you know where to start? Not all words are created equal. We use certain words far more often than others. English has at least 250,000 words, but if you only knew the top 100 words in English, you'd recognize half of everything you read. we get a lot of mileage out of our most frequent words. To be fair, many of these words are so-called function words, old standbys like be and of, in and on. And they behave differently in every language, so you can't start with those. You'll need a few nouns before you can put something in them or on them. Still, even if you set function words aside for a moment, you'll find a small group of useful, simple words that you use all the time. These words are an excellent place to start a language because you'll see them everywhere. They'll let you work more efficiently because you're not wasting your time with rare words. You are 79 times more likely to talk about your mother than your niece. Why not learn mother first and niece later? Grammar books and language classes don't follow this principle, in part because it's easy to plan lessons around themes like family or fruit. As a result, you'll find niece and mother in the exact same place in your grammar book, regardless of their relative utility. In language classes, you'll learn words for apricots and peaches, when your time would be much better spent learning about laptops, medicine, and energy. These are the words of our lives. Why not learn them first? Enter the word frequency list. Researchers take a giant mass of text, millions of words from TV scripts, novels, newspapers, the internet, news broadcasts, academic papers, and magazines, and jam it all into a computer. The computer counts the words and spits out gold, the words of a language in order of their importance. It's an extraordinary tool. With only 1,000 words, you'll recognize nearly 75% of what you read. With 2,000, you'll hit around 80%. As you might expect, you'll run into diminishing returns after a while, but these frequency lists provide an incredible foundation for your language. In practice, they're also extremely weird. You gain an ability to talk about complex topics before you can do the simple language tasks found in textbooks. I showed up to a Russian immersion program with the top 1,000 words in my head. In the entrance exam, I responded to 2 essay questions. Question 1, you have a party. What will you buy? Make a shopping list. Question 2, should teacher salaries scale according to the performance of their students? My answer to the first question was fairly embarrassing. I didn't have the right vocabulary for a shopping list. I wrote something like, I will buy meat, lots of meat, chicken, beef, and pork, delicious, all types of meat, and beer, vodka, also many bottles of wine. Oh yes, in addition we shall have bread with cheese. Ugh. My answer to the second question was a 4-page long rant about governmental policy in the United States and the media's effect upon societal opinion. They placed me in the advanced class. Within a few weeks, I picked up the vocabulary I was missing. My shopping lists are significantly longer now. Frequency lists aren't the end-all of vocabulary study. Eventually, you may want to talk about your niece and her love of apricots, but they're an ideal place to start. We've already covered the basics of pronunciation, and you can learn many of these words without using a shred of English. Russian dogs may not be our best friends, but they do look the same. As such, you can learn these words with pictures alone. So how should we begin? The most frequent words aren't the same in every language. You won't need Republican to learn Russian, and collective Soviet farming community doesn't show up in Spanish very often. Each language has its own frequency list. The best frequency dictionaries, incidentally, are published by Routledge. And these lists are fascinating, both because of the words they include and the words they don't. Unfortunately, these lists can be cumbersome. At least in the beginning, you're looking for words that are easy to visualize. Words like bus and mother. You could find them in your language's frequency list, but you'd have to root through hundreds of function words like the and abstract words like society. This can get tedious, which is why I'm giving you a shortcut. Despite the differences between languages, there is a fair amount of overlap in every language's most frequent words. We'll use that overlap to save us time. In Appendix 5, you'll find a list of 625 words in English to start with. These words are practical, easy to visualize, and quick to translate. Words like dog, school, car, and city. I'll show you how to turn them into flashcards and put them into your SRS with pictures and without their English translations. Because your flashcards won't have any English on them, you'll learn to see a dog and immediately think about the corresponding word in your target language. There's no pesky translation step to get in the way, and that will provide you with substantial rewards. First, you'll solidify the pronunciation foundation you built in the previous chapter. With every word you learn, you'll become increasingly familiar with the sound and spelling system of your language. As a result, you'll find that your words become easier and easier to remember. Second, you'll also get used to connecting sounds to images and concepts. You're learning to absorb words into your vocabulary, just as you did as a kid. Back then, you asked your parents about new words. What's that? A skunk. Oh. And once you asked, you never forgot. Now you're going to have the tools to find this information yourself. What's more, because of your SRS, you'll learn your words faster than a kid can, and you'll be literate from the very beginning. Third, you'll often learn key prefixes and suffixes without even trying. Your language equivalents of the ER in teacher, or the TION in train station, which will make future words with the same prefixes and suffixes easier to remember. Finally, when you get to grammar and abstract vocabulary, you'll already know most of the words you need. This makes the rest of your new language much easier to learn. It's easy to manage a sentence like "my dog chased a cat up a tree" when you already know dogs, cats, chasing, and trees. You'll know the players and actions in your stories, and grammar will simply tell you who's chasing whom. Key points. 1. You use certain words much more frequently than others. Learn those words first. 2. In Appendix 5, I give you a list of 625 simple, common words. These words are easy to visualize, and so you can learn them with pictures instead of translations. This will give you the foundation you need to easily learn abstract words and grammar in the next two chapters. Games with words. We are never more fully alive, more completely ourselves, or more deeply engrossed in anything than when we are at play. Charles Schaeffer. We have two goals in this chapter. We need to hear the music in our words, and we need to remember it when we do. In chapter 2, we talked about our mental filters and how they save us from information overload. To learn vocabulary efficiently, we'll need to overcome those filters by creating memorable, interesting experiences with our words. You can accomplish these goals through a series of quick games, which you'll play whenever you learn new words. The first will show you what your words really mean, and the second will connect that meaning to your own life. Here, fun is serious business. If you get bored, your mental filters will turn on, and all of your precious work will leak out of your ears. So take a moment to have fun. It's much more efficient. To create a deep multisensory memory for a word, you'll need to combine several ingredients: spelling, sound, meaning, and personal connection. We've discussed spelling and sound in the previous chapter, and you'll reinforce that knowledge with every word you learn. You can look up the spelling of each of your words in a dictionary or the glossary section of a grammar book, and you can usually find pronunciation information in the same place, supplemented by recordings at Forvo.com. Next comes meaning. Game 1. The Spot the Differences Game. Finding meaning through Google Images. In the beginning of this chapter, we talked about the limitations of translation, how translation strips words of their music. We're going to put the music back by playing with the greatest illustrated book ever written, Google Images. Google Images is Google's search engine for pictures. You may have used it already. You go to images.google.com, type in "smiling man with an iguana," and poof, you have 200,000 images of iguanas and men. Hooray. If you were so inclined, you could take these images, pull out a dictionary, and make some flashcards for la iguana, iguana, el hombre, man, and sonreír, to smile. This is a fine use of time, but not extremely interesting. You can do better by searching for your words in your target language. Hidden beneath Google Images' colorful exterior is a treasure trove. Every image comes with a caption, and those captions exist in 130 languages. You can search for some obscure word, aiguillage, French for railroad switch, and get 160,000 examples of that word in context, along with more pictures of railroad switches than you know what to do with. It's an effectively unlimited source of tiny illustrated stories about every word you need to learn. These images come from websites in your target language, and so they can tell you precisely how a word is used. The Russian word девушка means girl. Simple enough. But Google Images will tell you a much more nuanced and weird story. Nearly every девушка in Google Images is a close-up chest shot of an 18-year-old girl in a bikini. You look at this and you think, hmm. And this hmm is exactly what we're after. It's the moment you realize that Russian words aren't just funny-sounding English words. They're Russian words. And Russian words wear less clothing than you might expect, especially given the cold climate. These hmm moments get seared into your brain because they are interesting. While you might be a bit disturbed by the sexual overtones in Dievushka, you will certainly remember them. When you research a word using Google Images, you're playing the spot the differences game. You're looking for the difference between what you expect to see and what you actually see. The game is a lot of fun. The internet is full of weird, funny pictures in all sorts of languages. What's a German grandmother look like? What's a Hindi cake? Take 10 to 20 seconds to play, and then move on to the next word before you get sucked in for an hour. You'll store your memories of this game into your flashcards. Every time you encounter a "hmm" moment, you've gone through a rich, multisensory experience with a new word. You'll want your flashcards to bring those experiences back. You'll choose one or two images that you found particularly telling, perhaps one of the grandmothers that seemed especially German, and you'll put them into your flashcards. If you're drawing your pictures by hand, then you can create a reminder however you choose. I suspect stick figure Dievushkas wear stick bikinis. Game 2. The Memory Game. Boosting meaning through personal connection. Images by themselves are very powerful. Somewhere in your head, you store every image you see. In the process of searching for your images, you create a unique, memorable experience for every word in your vocabulary, and your flashcards will serve as reminders of your personal spot the differences game. Because you've chosen or drawn your own images, you'll be able to differentiate between words with easily conflated images like girl, woman, daughter, mother, granddaughter, and grandmother. You can make your word memories even more distinct by adding a personal connection. You are playing the memory game. What's your grand-mère or grandmother's name? Which chat or cat comes to your mind first? You're looking for any memory that you can connect with your new word. If you can find one, you've just made your word 50% more memorable. Even if you can't, the process of searching for a memory gives you a major boost. I've tried to find a connection to the number 32 in Hungarian, and I can't. It's the worst number ever. I don't think I've ever said 32 in English. Now, whenever I see 32, my first thought is, oh, yeah, that's 32, the worst number ever. Mission accomplished. To play the memory game, you'll spend a few seconds looking for any memory about your word that comes to mind. It could be your childhood cat or your friend's t-shirt. Try to keep the new word in mind rather than the translation. You'll make some weird English-French hybrid sentence like, the last time I saw my grand-mère was last weekend. Don't worry about the lack of French grammar. No one can hear you. As you make your flashcards, you'll write down a little reminder of this memory. The city you were in last weekend, the name of a friend you were with, and so on. Later, when you review your flashcards, you'll play the same game. You'll see a cat, scan your memory for anything that connects, and if you get stumped, you'll find a helpful reminder on the back of your flashcard. These connections aren't your main focus. You want to see a cat and think sha, but they can make your job easier by making your sha and your grand-mère more relevant to your own life, and therefore much more memorable. Key points. 1. You can make your words more memorable in two ways, by investigating the stories they tell and by connecting those stories to your own life. 2. When you create flashcards, use the best storytelling tool ever invented, Google Images. 3. Then spend a moment to find a link between each word and your own experiences. The gender of a turnip. I don't want to talk grammar. I want to talk like a lady in a flower shop. Eliza Doolittle to Henry Higgins, Pygmalion, George Bernard Shaw. At this point, you're doing pretty well. You've taken the spelling and pronunciation of a word and connected it to a page full of imagery. You've played Spot the Differences and chosen your favorite image or two, and you've played the memory game and connected your word with a personal experience. You've built a multisensory memory into your new word, and you have a flashcard or two that will remind you about all of these experiences at precisely the moment when you need it. Your little orchestra is starting to play, and it sounds pretty good. Are you done? Maybe. You're still missing your cello section, grammar, but you might not need it just yet. Whether you need a little grammar now or later depends upon what language you're learning. I'll explain. In English, we treat most of our nouns equally. We can take a sentence, I bought a dog, and swap in a different noun, I bought a cat, without screwing up the grammar. Unfortunately, this doesn't work in many languages. other languages' cats can fall into a different grammatical group than their dogs. This was once the case in English. 1,000 years ago, we talked about andoka, a dog, and anukate, a cat. And woe be unto you if you forgot the u in anukate. Eventually, we got sloppy with our grammar, and we forgot the grammatical differences between dogs and cats. But many languages didn't. In any of these languages, you need to memorize each noun's grammatical group in order to build a sentence successfully. This is known as grammatical gender, and it's a pain in the neck. Modern English still contains a similar sort of madness. Why, oh why, my English students ask, can't we buy a milk? I know this one. Because milk is uncountable, I respond. You might want a gallon or a cup or a drop or a swimming pool. But then why can't we tell you an information, they retort. You could have one information to say. This is unfortunately true. Germans frequently talk about an information or informations without causing any confusion. I try imagery. In English, information is metaphorical. We think of information like a big ocean. We take out a bit and tell it to each other. And a luggage? A luggage is metaphorical too? The real question my students are asking is, why doesn't grammar make sense? And the answer is illuminating. Grammar is a mirror to ourselves. It is a living history of our desire to make sense of our words. In English, we're currently turning sneaked into snuck. To many ears, snuck seems to sound better, but that's not why we're doing it. We're doing it because it makes two nonsensical verbs, stuck and struck, seem a little less nonsensical. We did this to catched several hundred years ago, putting it into a group with taught, bought, and thought, and we'll probably turn dragged into drug before the next century is up. We like to have groups of words that follow patterns, even when those patterns are irregular verbs in this case. Don't really make sense. And so, it's not surprising that we create nonsensical groups for our nouns, too, like uncountable, luggage, and countable, bags, or that the Germans have feminine, German turnips, masculine, German cheese, and neuter, German maidens. These are two sides of the same coin. We just like making groups, sensible or not. Sooner or later, you're going to encounter nonsensical groups like these. If you're studying a Germanic, Romantic, Slavic, Semitic, or Indian language, you need to deal with this now. Each of your words has a gender, and these genders don't make any sense. To quote Mark Twain, Gretchen. Wilhelm, where is the turnip? Wilhelm, she has gone to the kitchen. Gretchen, where is the accomplished and beautiful English maiden? Wilhelm, it has gone to the opera. Mark Twain, The Awful German Language. Unfortunately, in any of the languages with genders, you have to know a word's gender before you can do anything with it, which is why your grammar book starts with a long tirade about gender in the first or second chapter. Your book will either tell you that you just have to memorize it, or give you a pile of rules with a list of exceptions that you just have to memorize. The book is right. You do need to memorize it. But there is an easy way to do this, and I'll show you how in our next game. If your language doesn't have gender, if you're studying one of the languages of Eastern Asia, the Philippines, or Turkey, then you can breathe easy for now. But don't worry. You'll find your own uses for our mnemonic game soon enough. Game 3. The Mnemonic Imagery Game. How to Memorize Nonsensical Bits of Grammar. To continue with the German genders, a tree is male, its buds are female, its leaves are neuter. Horses are sexless, dogs are male, cats are female, tomcats included, of course. A person's mouth, neck, bosom, elbows, fingers, nails, feet, and body are of the male sex, and his head is male or neuter according to the word selected to signify it, and not according to the sex of the individual who wears it. For in Germany, all the women wear either male heads or sexless ones. A person's nose, lips, shoulders, breast, hands, and toes are of the female sex, and his hair, ears, eyes, chin, legs, knees, heart, and conscience haven't any sex at all. The inventor of the language probably got what he knew about a conscience from hearsay. Mark Twain, The Awful German Language. Welcome to the Mnemonic Imagery Game. In the next few minutes, you're going to memorize the genders of 12 of Twain's troublesome nouns. You'll do it quickly, you'll do it easily, you'll even have fun. Let's go. Tree, masculine. Tree bud, feminine. Leaf, neuter. Horse, neuter. Dog, masculine. Cat, feminine. Mouth, masculine. Neck, masculine. Hand, feminine. Nose, feminine. Knee, neuter, and heart. Neuter. You might be able to memorize these by rote repetition, but not for more than a few minutes. We'll try something a bit more interesting and long-lasting instead. I want you to imagine all of the masculine nouns exploding. Your tree? Kaboom. Splinters of wood everywhere. A branch gets embedded in the wall behind you. Dog chunks splatter all over the ceiling and floors. You wipe bits of fur and gore from your forehead. Make your images as vivid as you can stomach. Feminine nouns should catch fire. Your nose spews fire out of it like a dragon. A flaming cat sets fire to your bedroom. Feel the heat of each image. The more senses you can involve, the better. Neuter items should shatter like glass. Jagged, brown, red, sparkling shards of horse spread across the floor, as does your broken heart. Take a moment to imagine the remaining images yourself. Masculine. An exploding mouth. And an exploding neck. Feminine. A burning hand. And a burning tree bud. Neuter. A shattering leaf. And a shattering knee. See how many of these images stick. We can even mix up the order to be tricky. Tree. Leaf. Horse. Dog. Cat. Mouth. Neck. Hand. Nose. Heart. Knee. Tree bud. Not too bad, huh? Depending upon how vivid your images were, you may have remembered all of them, and if you missed a few, you'd get better with practice. Mnemonic images work for reasons you might already surmise. We are really good at remembering images, particularly when those images are violent, sexual, funny, or any combination of the three. While gender can conjure up some images, you can probably imagine a male dog, it falls flat on others, a neuter knee. Meh. Vivid, action-packed verbs are much more memorable. To play the mnemonic image game in your language, you'll need to come up with images for the nonsensical grammatical groups in your new language. Since we're restricting ourselves to noun genders for the moment, then you'll need two or three particularly vivid verbs, since verbs combine well with nouns. Later, when you're making your flashcards, you can use mnemonic imagery as needed. If a man is masculine in your target language, you probably don't need imagery for that word. But if you're making a flashcard for a maiden, neuter, then take a few seconds to shatter her into a thousand maidenly pieces. Make your images as vivid and multisensory as you can. If you do, you'll have an easy time recalling each word's gender whenever you review. And if you get stumped, you can create a new image then and there. After a few hundred words, you'll begin to do this automatically with every new word, and gender will cease being a problem from then on. As you learn more, you'll find that this tool can come in handy everywhere. Anytime you encounter some frustrating group of irregularities you just have to memorize, you can create a mnemonic image. You can even make images for spelling. If CH is for sha, cat, then that cat can ride on top of your CHEVAL, cheval, horse. We'll cover more advanced uses of mnemonics in Chapter 5. I use this game personally for all sorts of nasty things. Verb conjugations, prepositions, noun cases, and irregular plurals, to name a few. Until then, make a few images and try it out. It's a fun tool, and it makes light work of one of the hardest aspects of language learning. Key points. 1. Many languages assign a nonsensical grammatical gender to each of their nouns, which is a standard source of trouble for language learners. 2. If your language has grammatical gender, you can memorize it easily if you assign each gender a particularly vivid action, and then imagine each of your nouns performing that action. Do this now. Learn your first 625 words, music, and all. You're about to learn a lot of words very quickly. You'll play some games, make some flashcards, and within a month or two, you can expect to have a 625-word vocabulary. But you'll have much more than the ability to name some objects. You'll have a foundation. In this stage, you're learning to connect sounds and spellings to meaningful words. This is a huge leap past what we've all done in language classes. You're learning to associate a new word, gato, to images, feelings, and sounds of cats found throughout your memories. Rather than translating your gatos into cats, you're learning to put music into your words. This is no small feat. You're beginning to think in your new language, and this skill will follow you for the rest of your journey. You're going to learn this skill by studying flashcards in your SRS, but the key moments occur in the beginning, when you create those flashcards. In those moments, you're taking new words and connecting them to as many images, thoughts, and memories as you can find. You're creating the core connections that will underlie your language, and of equal importance, you're having a good, and therefore memorable, time in the process. Your flashcards are just a practical souvenir of that experience. You'll only use them to deepen memories you've already formed. We'll talk about the nitty-gritty of flashcard creation in the gallery later on in this book. You can go to that section when you're ready to actually make your cards. Here, we'll talk about the connections we're building, the sounds, images, spellings, and memories in each word, and how to build those connections as quickly as possible. The connections. Sound, spelling, meaning, personal connection, and perhaps gender. We've already discussed sound and spelling in the previous chapter. These are the special pieces of a word that allow us to imagine an image, a unicorn, for example, and send that image to another person. They're the basic substance of each word, and as you learn your words, this substance will become more familiar and easier to remember. Next comes meaning. You'll want to discover what your words actually mean, rather than what their translations seem to mean. What do Russian девушкas, or girls, wear? And what do the French eat for déjeuner, or lunch? You'll want to build new, meaningful associations into every word you learn. Finally, you'll want personal connections. While your new words may not line up perfectly with their English translations, they will line up with your own experiences. We've all met девушкas and eaten déjeuner. We need to bring out these memories and remember when they happened, how we felt, what we heard, and what we saw. If your language uses gender, you'll want that mixed into your words too. Right from the beginning, your masculine nouns should be different from your feminine nouns, and you can create those differences with vivid mnemonic imagery. Every one of these connections will make your words easier to remember and easier to use in the future. Any flashcards you create will be a dim reminder of the colorful mass of memories you assemble. When you review them, they'll bring back a fragment of those memories, and your brain will supply the rest in a sudden rush of color, feeling, and music. Then you'll move on to the next card. It's an intense, unforgettable experience. Resources. 1. Translations and spelling. In Appendix 5, you'll find a list of 625 English words that show up frequently in every language. Dog, car, city, and so on. You'll want to find translations for each of these words in your target language. You could use Google Translate, but you'll usually get a lot of weird, messed up translations. Machine translation is not that good, especially when you're translating lists of words rather than sentences. If you use a standard dictionary, you may find too many results. You don't need 10 synonyms for house. Now here's your chance to use that pocket phrasebook you bought. Phrasebooks are quick to peruse, and they'll give you the most frequently used translations for each word. If you don't have one, you might be able to get the same results from the glossary section of your grammar book. Alternatively, if you're studying a relatively common language, you can probably find a professional translation of the 625 words on my website. Go to fluent-forever.com/appendix5. 2. Sound. You'll find recordings of your words at forvo.com. Listen to them, particularly in the beginning, when your connections between sound and spelling are still wobbly. You'll have an easier time understanding what you hear if you also use phonetic transcriptions of your words. You may find these in your glossary, but if not, you'll find them in your favorite dictionary and or Wiktionary.org. 3. Meaning. Find your word in Google Images. You have a couple options here, the first of which is easy to use and great, and the second of which takes a bit of initial setup, but is awesome. Use number 2. Option 1, basic version. When you go directly to images.google.com, you can find pictures, but you won't see the best part, the captions. To turn them on, go to tinyurl.com/basic-image, and then bookmark that page. There you'll see a wonderful page with 20 images, and captions for any word you look up. Option 2. Basic version automatically translated. Those captions are great, but they're all in your new language, and you don't speak that language yet. What if all those little captions were